So interesting to be like discussing both the differences of the human brain vis-a-vis the chimp's brain or animal brains, and then also what makes us so similar as human beings all around the world. That's the premise of the book Human, the science behind what makes us unique. Dr. Michael Gazzagna, just getting into the most interesting parts of the book, you cannot miss it. Some of the studies, some of the research they've done, and what it tells us about us. Next on Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. So, Dr. Michael Gazzagna, the book is Human, the Science Behind What Makes Us Unique. Before we get back to the moral part of the brain, which is very interesting, real quick thought on are there any other brains at all on the planet that function higher, or we think might someday be found to function higher than the human brain? I'm thinking specifically of like whale brains, like mammal brains, giant mammal brains.
Right. They're bigger, but then when you take their body size into account, they're teeny.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, you knock them down to size. You always have to look at the size of the brain relative to the body size, because a lot of that brain stuff is just managing the sensory motor parts of the big body. And so we don't expect whales to take over the Harvard entry. What people do worry about is, of course, as I try to cover a little of this in the last chapter, is artificial intelligence and robots. Are they going to start to whip us? And I'm very cautious about that. I don't think so.
Well, that is a great question, is can we use all of our smarts to create a brain that's smarter than us, or a brain that learns in a fashion, in a sort of algorithm like fashion that is more than the sum of the parts, right? I mean, I think isn't that that'd be the big fear?
So you remember when Big Blue, the IBM computer, beat Garry Kasparov in the big chess game?
Right.
Kasparov made this great comment afterwards. He says, "I don't know what that was, but it wasn't playing chess." And that's exactly right. It wasn't thinking. The machine has no insight as to what it's doing. It's simply calculating out a gazillion times per second what the implications of a move are. And obviously, at some point, the human brain is limited. But playing chess is knowing the history of moves and all kinds of stuff that make the game very human. And you have to be super smart to do it. So when these machines with these powerful computational calculating abilities come along, they are that. And in fact, that's why we build them. We can't do that very fast. And so we want them for that, but they're not really human-like at all.
Well, let me challenge that a little bit, just
Sure.
because I think that sounds to me a little bit like a classic example of he who controls the vocabulary controls the debate. And if we're going to define what they're doing, and in a way that says, well, they did this and they did this and they did that, but they didn't do X, Y, or Z, so it's not really chess, because we're going to say part of chess is knowing the history of the move, or knowing some of the implications of the move. Maybe it's not. I mean, what if chess really is just, I mean, and to win or lose at chess, it's a game, it's a simple objective. Can you make the correct number of almost mathematical or geometric decisions to overtake your opponent's variables? And maybe that's all that chess really is. And we like to dress it up by thinking you have to know the history, you got to know all, but it comes right down to it. Do you really, if how much does the history of war help you if you lose the battle?
Well, I mean, I'm not that good a chess player, so I've never been at the point where my game varies that much from A to B. But I'm told that at the high level of playing chess, that the chess player is taking into account the particular strategies that the other player has used, and they knows them, and so when he takes particular risks, he has probabilities in his mind about how the other person is going to respond, and so forth and so on, stuff like that, which the computer isn't solving, isn't beating you that way at all. It's beating you by just projecting out through brute force of calculation what the implications are of any particular move, and how to counteract that. So it's just the guys that do this say it's just doing something different. It's not psychologically beating you the way we psychologically beat each other in these kinds of games. And I'll leave
so maybe it's a purer form of chess.
Well, it's something. I mean, it's certainly a way of playing a game, and two computers can have at it, and that's fine. But the way the human mind tackles the game is just different.
Okay, all right. So I know I should probably give this up, but I'm fascinated a little bit by that because it sounds to me like we're tilting on a human bias. That we could say we've invented a machine that that could compete against us in hopscotch. And then when we lose to that machine in hopscotch, our response is, yeah, but the machine didn't appreciate that it was a sunny day and it's a nice sidewalk. And so therefore it's not really hopscotch. Yeah. And I think, well, okay, that sounds like a lot of sort of intellectual sour grapes. I mean, I don't know. So what is then the future of artificial intelligence? Do you anticipate a ceiling of artificial intelligence?
What's going to happen? There's two things going on. There's computers as we've currently built them to be these big computational machines, do all these calculations a billion times a second and all that kind of stuff that the human brain can't do. And that's terrific, and we use those, and we depend on them, and you got one right in front of you right there and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
But now there's this interest in building a brain-like computer that we deal with the world's information differently, and we are a special kind of computer. Well, to build that kind of computer means you need to know more about how the brain does its thing. And there are people who are working on that. Given the way the brain computes information, maybe we could build a computer that better mimics the brain. And one of the guys that's doing a lot of thinking about that is the man with tremendous smarts, and it was the founder and creator of the Palm Pilot. And he's written a book on this, and he's put his money where his mouth is. He has a certain model about it, which I describe in the book. And he's trying to start a company that is going to do this, going to have a brain-based way of computing, and that may change things. And out of that may come a more biologically real computer than the kinds that we certainly have right now. When we built our first computers, the ones we enjoy now, we didn't want it to be like the brain. Brain, it's kind of slow and clunky in a lot of things. So we wanted this fast computation and went to other ways.
We look at some of the smart technology of warfare, and I know this is a little bit of a sidebar, but it seems like technology, the focus of technology in many ways is always to save human life or to ease human life in some way. And I wonder that pursuit, and this is just a sidebar question, but that's been kind of a holy grail pursuit of technology and intellectual capacity for years. We're always trying to come up with something that sort of spares us from us, right? The bomb that will end all wars, you know, or something like that. And it never quite does. And I wonder, does that speak to the fact about the limitation of the human brain to be able to think outside of a set of circumstances where we always seem to think, well, this will end the war, and it might end a war for the next 2 years, but it ends up creating a war 10 years later?
Well, you can't change the percentages of the bad guys. So, you know, with the 6 billion people on Earth, if 1% of them are bad guys, 99% of us are good guys, 1% are bad guys, that's a lot of people.
Right.
Making mischief, right?
True.
And one of them gets in a position to turn a technology around, and the phrase is dual purpose, right? You built it to do good, but it winds up doing bad. One of those guys gets hold of it and uses it to do bad. you've got a problem on your hands. And we're continually fighting that. I mean, one could say, this is my field, but the whole atomic bomb and nuclear bomb situation so far has prevented the world from killing each other. And now we're worried about it getting into the bad guy's hands and doing mischief. So that's, that's a big example. But
yet for decades, we were convinced they were in the bad guy's hands.
Yeah.
And it ended up not killing us.
Yeah. And they were in the bad guy's hands in that social context.
Right.
But this, you know, we don't have to go to the big one, the nuclear bomb. There's all kinds of weapons now that are used to be more selective, reduce who you're killing, try to distinguish between civilian and the warriors and the children and the women and the innocents and so forth and so on. And you're quite right. These people who are in this business have as a goal to lessen the damage and get the political objective done.
But I wonder how much of that we should just admit that our human brain, as strong as an organ as it is in so many other respects, just by history, we seem unable to use it in certain areas. We'll just never be able to be as good as we think we can be. That there are limitations somehow to the scope of our abilities, that the smartest people in the world can't come up with a bomb that truly, in the end, ends all wars.
Yeah, I just don't think it works that way.
Yeah.
We are stuck with our brains and how they're built and what we do, so far nothing's changing that. So all the technology that has come on, and when you think about it, it's really amazing. What we're talking about here is things that have basically happened in the last 75 years of human history. And that's about, a couple of milliseconds
right.
of the whole cosmic.
Sure,
scale.
On the timeline of all. You said before 1%. Let's just say 1% of all human beings.
Yeah, I just picked that out of the air.
No, I like that idea. Let's just go with that number. Let's say it's 1% that are truly demented sociopaths whose pursuit in life is to bring as much misery and destruction as they can to the rest of the planet.
Right. Whatever
that figure is, whether it's 0.5 or whether it's 2%, I don't know.
Right.
Why are they like that? What does science tell us about those types of people?
Well, it's funny you should ask. There is a big new project going on that is trying to examine that. What is to put it in scientific terms, what is the neurophysiologic basis of psychopathy? Or let's put it another way. What do we know about the brains of serial killers? And I know a little bit about the latter, and we know nothing about the brains of serial killers. Science knows nothing. Science knows nothing. They've looked. They can't see what's wrong, and so forth and so on. So the psychologists think that what these people do is just devalue humans, and they can't tell the difference between a human and a rock. They don't have the proper emotional response to a fellow human, so to violate them in some way, whether it's through actual violence or stealing from them or conning them or whatever, but that doesn't mean anything to them because they don't have the normal emotional response of the importance of the other person. And there's going to be studies coming out, I think, that confirm or kind of further articulate what is the emotional dimension of that's off in people who behave like this.
Well, okay, and so then when you say emotional basis, then we say this is not a hardware issue. This is a software issue.
No. Emotions are hardware, too. I mean,
okay.
I'm throwing that out there. I want to be careful about that because there's so many psychosocial issues that, that influence people's behavior that one can't. There's a wonderful phrase by a friend of mine, brain overclaim.
Well, that's so interesting. Yeah, I'm sort of hinting at that, but that's a perfect way to phrase that.
Yeah,
right.
and we got to keep ourselves honest on this. You know that, of course, if you're in neuroscience, you just every day you just learn new things, and you can't believe what you're learning. But on the other hand, there's so much we don't know that you shouldn't freely say that you will understand that. You got to work at it. So, I mean, for example, it's extremely difficult, and nothing really exists now that works in lie detection. And yet, it's very commonly used and thought that there is. Well, okay, so that's brain overclaim that we could do that. So we gotta pull these things back and be sober-minded about it.
Is there anything we can do to juice our brains? Or is it the cards we're dealt when we're a kid, given... you know, a certain amount of, kid-tested, mother-approved breakfast cereals and, you know, Wonder Bread that grows a strong body 12 ways. I mean, given that just as like a basic nutrition, other than that, can we actually improve our brains, the organ of our brains, like we could, say, improve our pectoral muscles or something?
Well, there's a huge pharmacological industry that would be so pleased to be able to develop memory drugs, for example,
right?
As drugs that would enable us, those of us getting out of here, can't remember where we put our car keys, that kind of thing. But the two-edged sword there is that if these drugs, and there's nothing really good out there now on the market, but people are studying this intensely. But should an enhancer come along, okay? Is it going to be misused? This is the dual use problem again. Is it going to be misused where people will use this to get through an exam, will use this to get through an interview, will use this in a way that makes it so that they don't forget so easily? You know, one of the healthy things in life is to forget stuff so you can move forward. And if we start using these pharmacological agents to enhance, there's got to be a lot of of safety studies done to make sure that very vivid memories aren't a bad thing.
So you put that in a future context of if we would, when isn't it an absolute guarantee that we will? I mean, there's something about us. I mean, you know, we
guarantee we'll have these enhancements.
The guarantee that A, we'll have these enhancements, and B, that we'll abuse them.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's an absolute dead on guarantee.
I agree.
100%. Viagra, Adderall, Ritalin, amphetamines, painkillers. Let's go down the line.
Yep, you're right.
So it's not even a question to me. I mean, I think you almost have to anticipate, much like you propose the 1% of people who might have, sociopathic tendencies or something, that we could just anticipate 10% of the population will abuse these drugs, no matter how many public service announcements we run or how many celebrities get busted for it or whatever.
Right.
They're just going to.
It's the clean version of the drug problem, right?
Right.
Well, there's all kinds of education about the lack of wisdom of using drugs, and yet there's a base rate of abuse that causes all kinds of social problems.
Elvis still died of drug abuse, even though all of his drugs were legal.
Yeah.
Yeah. Human, the science behind what makes us unique, Dr. Michael Gazzagna, and we'll get to, I want to get to some of the ethical stuff that's built into the brain, too, and explore that in a little bit. And don't worry, your questions and comments coming up, too, on your own brains. What are you struggling with your brain? And what might inform you about you coming up when we get to the phones on Coast to Coast AM? This is Ian Punnett. If you go online at coasttocoastam.com, that's our website, you'll see some great stories, including that weird story about the missing statue in Scranton, Pennsylvania. They just figured out that one of their Lincoln statues is missing. Don't know where it is. They're looking all over the country for it. Take a look at it and see if you don't have that somewhere in your attic or your garage. It's a 16-foot high bust of Lincoln, but hey, maybe it's under a tarp. You forgot to look in lately. And if you go to the blog too, you'll see the other crypto news from the first hour if you missed it. coasttocoastam.com, then click on to the blog. It'll take you from there. Hope you had a nice 4th of July. The weekend is just getting cranked up though. George is doing the show tomorrow night, and we're not done. with Dr. Michael Gazzagna. The book is Human, The Science Behind What Makes Us Unique. And we'll get back to it coming up next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Ponet. Oh, man, I'm such an idiot. I'm so sorry about that. Again, slipped back to my original mispronunciation somewhere along the way. Dr. Michael Gazzaniga, right?
Oh, bingo.
No. And I know when I'm going to hear this tape, like, replayed on the radio, I'm going to be pounding the dashboard, screaming at myself, going, Gazzaniga, you idiot.
Hardly.
Mental block. I don't know why. So this book, and I'm really enjoying it. And I didn't get down to the last chapter yet on artificial intelligence, but I swear I'm going to finish this book, because with every page, I was like turning the page going, shut up. I mean, they're just like, that was amazing, or get out of here. I mean, they're just one little study after another. So it just really got to recommend this to folks if they're interested at all. This book is completely accessible. And even though it's written by a really smart guy with a really big brain, any of us puny humans can understand it. And The Ethical Brain was one of your other books. And I liked this, this sort of bioethical strain that runs even through this book. So I want to talk about that a little bit. Where, for example, are you on the idea that there's a God part of the brain, so to speak, and that certain people can have mystical experiences and other people can't, but it has nothing to do with the divine. It's only the way their brains are wired. Where are you with that?
Well, there's no question that there are huge differences in temperament between people, and that's a close measure for people who I think have spiritual experiences and all the rest of it. Here's how I think about it. I think about it that if we just all of a sudden were here and we didn't have all this history of religions and different cultural interpretations and so forth, we were just starting clean. We knew today, we know about science, we know about DNA, we know about this, we know about that. I'd say we'd be here about a day and religion would be invented. It's an invention that is very useful for many people to cope with the complexities of life. And they do it, and it is helpful to them. So I'm not mystified at all by the process by which the human generates the idea of and utility of religious stories or myths or the many, many things that we do. There's a wonderful observation, again, by John Tooby, who's one of the nation's greatest thinkers. He says, you know, the deal with humans is that that we're drawn to what he calls the fictitional experience. And why is it we want fantasy? Why is it we like art? Why is it we like to think about how things might be? And one of the reasons is because it prepares us for dealing with the future and unknown situations. We kind of can rehearse how we might deal with something. And that just that general tendency can take off, I think, and not only in as a great explanation for why we like the arts, and I mean by the arts, music, art.
Sure.
But also, I think it has a possible relationship to why we come up with beliefs as to the meaning of life and what is the meaning of life and how can I find meaning in life and therefore develop a religious view. And then you in a book I wrote many years ago, I said, you know, you look at the idea that came out of the Mesopotamia where there was wind and fire and miserable weather versus the idea about what it all means that came out of Egypt, which was clean and hierarchical and a real simple system. You can see how once you go to this question, why is it we who we are, why are we here, and what does all this mean? And then your brain's interpreters starts drawing upon the experience of the people asking the question. And if you live in a miserable environment, you have a different view of what the supernatural is than if you live in an orderly environment, and so forth and so on. So I guess that was a long-winded way of saying that. I'm not sorry for that, but
no, don't worry about it.
A long-winded way of saying that that religion plays a very important role in a lot of people's lives, and that's a good thing. I'm not on a rant about religion. I'm not religious, but I'm not on a rant about it.
No, I appreciate that, but I want to push you a little bit on that too, because it sounded, I mean, I understand that there's a difference to me between the construct of religion, which gives us a certain amount of, governors in our behavior or
sure.
attempts to understand why, as you mentioned before, something that's hardwired into the brain, like don't have sex with your sister, is why that is there, that somehow we get into we transpose those into higher laws, you know, they don't have to be explained, they just are. They're sort
right.
of phenomenological, they just, you have to accept them.
Right.
But to me there's a difference between religion and the divine or the mystical, and I'm not sure that I understand how that answer would account for mystical experiences and the so-called God part of the brain, where some people experience life with what they only can use as sort of a definition as a divine component, where they see and feel things differently than other people do. And it doesn't necessarily ascribe to any one religion, but it is a type of religious experience.
Right.
You understand the difference I'm drawing there?
Sure. Sure, absolutely. It's an important difference. And are there brain states to be understood that support this the more spiritual dimension and sensation of spiritual sensation? And I have little doubt that there are people who get into spiritual states, and that there has to be, therefore, some sort of underlying biology of it to be understood. I don't know what it is.
Right,
but could it be explained someday? Actually, there are people who try to explain it now, with various kinds of theories that we don't have to go into. But there are attempts at explaining that kind of thing now, and you make it a very important distinction.
Well, I'll push it in a different direction. I saw a UFO once. I saw a truly amazing thing. I still can't explain it. I ran it past the professors at Northwestern University, who at the time had formed the UFO Center and were studying all of these reports. I don't know whether it's little green men from Mars. I don't know. I just know I saw this amazing display of lights in the sky that has never been explained to me by anybody. And that experience of having seen something changed my cognitive outlook on how other people talk about their experiences too. And I can really like predate a kind of skepticism in my head of like, that's not possible, to after what I saw, I suddenly say, you know what, maybe you're right, maybe that is possible. I mean, suddenly the world just seemed like it had a broader set of variables than I might have been willing to admit to before, once I saw something that I couldn't explain. And I think in a way it just sort of changed everything about the way I thought, having seen something that I couldn't explain.
Mm-hmm.
And I look at that, and I've always tried to sort that out, because I feel dumber in a way for because other people are very logical and very scientific, and they say, well, that's simply, it just, it could not have been a UFO, it couldn't have been anything, it just was lights in the sky and that's all there is to it. But it'll never be that way for me. I can never, because I know what I saw, and it just sort of changed my whole world in a way.
Well, you know, we all have epiphanies, right?
Right.
All of a sudden, something becomes very clear, and that's and you're going to reorient your life to respond to this, quote, epiphany. So whether that phenomenon is much different than what you said, you had an external stimulus to trigger it, but maybe you were, things were brewing it within you anyhow to change
right.
your worldview about something. And it was changing, and then you mapped it on that experience and give it an explanation.
That's a good point.
That's how
that's interesting.
My training.
But that's okay. I mean, I think that's an interesting perspective. Let me then ask you, then, are you part of, we were talking about this last week, the change in the perception of free will, that free will is actually just a sum total of our brain firings, and that these the way that our brain fires, we don't understand until 10 seconds after we supposedly thought it. But what we didn't really think of a response. Our response was generated by fairly unconscious, a series of unconscious responses by our brain that tapped into history, that tapped into current conditions, that tapped into whatever, and gave us a response which we acted on, which we thought of as free will, but really wasn't free will. It was really our brain telling us to do something, and 10 seconds later we realized we found ourselves doing it. All right, where are you with that?
Well, that's a question I've thought a lot about, and I guess the question you have to ask yourself when people use this word free will, which I think is a misnomer, but anyway, the question you ask yourself is free from what? What do you mean? What do you want to be free from? What you don't want to be free from, it seems to me, is all of your life experiences, all the way you've made decisions in the past and remembered the payoffs, some worked, some didn't work, all the things you valued, you didn't value. You want your brain to keep track of all that stuff. And a new situation presents itself. You want that decision-making system to act, to do something. And when you and you want it to act in a way that is not interfered with by some willy-nilly thing coming in and interrupting those processes. So the way we work is that we make decisions about a choice in front of us from our past experience. And that is that's just how it works. And that goes on a little bit before we're consciously aware of it, and I think it's just a truism, because we all will admit that our mental life is derived from our brain. So that means by the time we're consciously aware of something, the brain must have already done it.
Well,
but that doesn't bother me. It bothers some people, but it doesn't bother me.
Oh, I understand that. I think that's a totally valid point to make. I looked at the science behind that last week, and they were talking about this study. I'm sure you saw it.
Yeah, I know the study.
Yeah. Okay, you probably conducted it, for God's sakes. But
no.
Yeah, but it
no,
was.
No, I didn't.
So scientists were looking at the way in which students or people in a research, you know, control group were responding. They could read their brain waves, and judging by their brain waves.
Yeah.
The scientists were able to predict, if I have the number correct, 70% of the time, which button, to simplify the experiment, which button the respondents were going to hit.
Right.
And so 70% of the time, they could read the brainwaves and go, left button, right button, left button, right button. But doesn't that 30% that they couldn't predict, does that suggest that those people had free will?
Well, no, that would just say to the dying-old scientists like me is that they haven't made all of the proper measurements yet for their prediction.
Okay.
when they finally get it done, they will be able to do that. But look, there's another article that came out last month that you would enjoy, that Jonathan Schuller and his buddies did this very cute study. They gave students a book by Francis Crick to read, okay? He's a great biologist, and he wrote a book. It's very deterministic. It's, you know, we're all part of a deterministic world, and we're determined, and blah 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 blah. and then he gave another group of students sort of some uplifting book that we're free to choose, and they were just reading this. They didn't know why they were reading it. They were waiting to do a test, right?
Right.
So then the kids go in, the two groups go in, and they do this test. And on this test, you can cheat. That's just set up that way by the experimenters. And so guess what? Who cheats? Who doesn't cheat? Well, the people that sort of basically were put into the set that there's no such thing as free will cheated like crazy. so as we kind of work our way through this argument, there's absolutely no question that it's a good thing to believe in and a good way to set up your society, because it seems to give rise to behaviors you don't want if you just think, oh, what the hell, you know.
Okay, but then to tie together some of the things you've talked about, that would suggest that merely reading that book could defeat the hardwired part of the brain that says cheating is bad.
Yeah, well, clever.
Then it's not hardwired.
That's clever.
Is it, doctor? Is it, doctor?
Yes, and the way a scientist would have to go about that is they would have to take the two conditions and match the story and the test and the thing and that and see if there was an effect.
Yeah. But I think that goes to an interesting thing, that we are willing to make that conclusion that, oh, look how easy it was to bypass something which we thought of as hardwired. Yeah. And if it's really that, then maybe it is much more about nurture and not nature when we think about cheating.
There's a tremendous thing about there's a tremendous input of nurture. I mean, when people point to a biologic mechanism we have these moral impulses, or we have this, or we have that. No one making those claims is saying that these things are not modulated by nurture, by cultural experience. It's all a question of degree that we're talking about here, and So, yeah, well, you know these arguments. They're important distinctions to make and keep in mind.
Before we get to the phones, and I could talk to you all night long, and I'm sure you want to get back to the lampshade-wearing party that's going on in Lake Tahoe right now with all you brain guys getting together. But we got an hour of phone calls coming up, and I know it's going to be interesting. But talk to me a little bit about this work you do as a bioethicist and the kind of advice that the government is coming to ask you about. What do you do exactly on this panel of bioethicists for the Bush administration or for the government?
Well, it was started in response, back in 2001 to the stem cell controversy and the stem cell issue.
Right.
How are we going to deal with the need for biomedical cloning versus reproductive cloning? Let's think through those issues. And so he set up a commission, and 18 people were appointed to look at the impact of biotechnology on the moral values of our culture. And various versions of this have been set up by other presidents in the past. And this one was called the President's Bioethics Council, and so we looked at that very difficult issue. And we've looked at these questions of enhancements. We've looked at the issues, the crazy issues now involved in organ transplantation and the great need for them because of the increasing problem of obesity in this country. And there's all of these have ethical dimensions to them, and this council tries to hash them out. And so it becomes a place where these issues are discussed, where the reports are put out. The council usually doesn't agree on them. The members have various positions. So there's majority opinions, there's minority opinions, there's individual opinions. And for people interested in these things, the website really has all these transcripts the last 6 or 7 years of this, and they make for fascinating reading. And one of the things I did in that Ethical Brain book was try to summarize them and really alert people to these issues.
Very interesting. Well, you can link up to Dr. Michael Gazzaniga coming up in just a minute. You can go to the website at coasttocoastam.com and jump in on this phone conversation, because we'll let you in on it next. On Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett.